From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The other point, I usually link female circumcision even to international politics. Sometimes I say there is a relationship between George Bush and female circumcision. So how come that there is a relationship?
In our continuing series of holiday specials, a conversation with Nawal El-Sadawi, writer, doctor, militant, leading spokesperson on the status of women in the Arab world. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Ramadan begins Wednesday night at sundown. The evening begins a month of prayer and meditation for Muslims around the world. It's also a time of abstinence and fasting, each day of that month from sunrise to sunset. In our continued series of specials for this holiday season, today we bring you an extended interview with Dr. Nawal El-Sadawi. Britain's Guardian newspaper calls her the leading spokeswoman on the status of women in the Arab world. I got a chance to interview her recently in New York City, where she'd been invited from Egypt to attend the Yari Yari Conference, a first-of-its-kind gathering of hundreds of women from the African continent and the diaspora. Writer, doctor, and militant Nawal El-Sadawi has had a major influence on the lives of women and men globally. She is the author of many books, both fiction and nonfiction, which challenge our thinking about the politics of sex, third world development, the Arab world, and writing itself. She's been a constant thorn in the side of the class and patriarchal systems. Removed from her post as Egypt's director of public health and imprisoned under Anwar Sadat for her political activities, she's continued undeterred to fight for equality of gender, nation, and race, in spite of the banning of her books and the rise of a variety of fundamentalisms all over the world. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Dr. El-Sadawi.
Thank you. Why don't we begin with your history in Egypt? How is it that you rose to be the director of public health and then ultimately were imprisoned under Anwar Sadat?
Well, that's very common. You know, many intellectuals, writers, even poets, and musicians, they go to jail if they oppose the government and the system. And in spite of the fact that Sadat, he said that he's starting democracy, that Nasser was a dictator and he's starting democracy. So I believed him and I started criticizing his policies, so I landed in jail. So this is very common. It's not something uncommon.
What were you critical of at the time? What year was it?
Well, this was just before his assassination, the year 1981. But at that time, I was writing. You know, I don't belong to any political party. Sadat put all opposition groups and individuals in jail during that, just before his assassination. He was in a state of madness. We called it madness. He was very angry because of the opposition, all types of opposition, right, left, Islamic, Copts, were criticizing him, his policy. As for me, it was natural. You know, I am a writer since I was very young, even before I graduated from the medical college. And I don't separate whatsoever between medicine and literature or facts and fiction. You know, to me, life is a whole. So if I write, for instance, if I worked as a physician, I was treating tuberculosis patients. So it's natural that I ask myself why people become sick, why people become unhappy. And then I discovered that I discovered poverty. When I discovered poverty and I ask myself why people become poor, then I am directly in politics. So if any medical doctor, if any physician really is aware of the real causes of poverty in society, then we cannot separate between medicine and politics, because this led me to political activity against the system that is impoverishing people, is making the majority of people in my country poor, while few people are multi-billionaires. This gap, big gap between the rich and the poor. So I felt that it's not enough just to cure people by medicine or by drugs. We have also to cure people by writing to them and creating awareness. And in fact, I was the Director General of Health Education in the Ministry of Health. And I felt that health education is very important. Education is very important. That people start themselves to prevent diseases and to be aware and to be conscious how can really they be healthy themselves. That's it. I find it quite natural. Many people ask me how come that you are a medical doctor and then you write novels. I find it's quite natural that I do not separate between science and art at all. The same, I do not separate between body and spirit and mind. This separation or split between science and art, or body, mind, and spirit, is false. It's false. It's not real, because we are a whole. And if I study science, then I can write fiction. No problem whatsoever.
We're talking to Dr. Nawal El Sadawi, and she's the author of many books. Her writings have been put together, some of them, in a new book called The Nawal El Sadawi Reader. But among the many books she's written is one that she got particular attention for, actually right before your imprisonment, The Hidden Face of Eve, which dealt with the issue of female circumcision. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, first, The Hidden Face of Eve was translated to English in 1980, so many years ago. But I wrote it in Arabic 10 years before that. And it dealt with women oppression in the Arab region and also in other countries in the West, because I think that the oppression of women is universal. And also female circumcision is universal. Many people, especially here in the West, they think that female circumcision is specific to Africa. This is not true. Female circumcision was done in Asia, in Europe, even in the States. Some people think it's related to religion, to Islam, for instance. This is not true. Most of the Islamic countries, they know nothing about female circumcision. So female circumcision is related to what we call the class patriarchal system or the slave system. Since thousands of years, when this system started, women became slaves to men, and the society was divided into slaves and masters. And the family, the man became the head of the family, and patriarchy is based on knowing the father. In order to know the father, the woman must marry only one man. If she marries two men, then fatherhood will never be known, and the whole patriarchal system will collapse. So in order to force monogamy on women, with monogamy, many procedures has to be done to women to attenuate their sexuality and to diminish their mobility so that they have only one man. In that way, one of these procedures was female circumcision, cutting the clitoris to diminish their sexual desire. Another procedure was veiling and seclusion. Quite a lot of people think that veiling is an Islamic habit or something related to Islam. This is not true. Veiling has nothing to do with Islam. It's related to the class patriarchal system. Also, unpaid work in the house is a way to limit the mobility of women, because if women do not have money, do not have wages, they cannot move, they cannot travel. So they have to be secluded in the house to work as wives and mothers, as servants to the family. The chastity belt also. So all these procedures happened in history to force monogamy on women and to support the patriarchal class system. So female circumcision is not just a sexual oppression of women. It is political, economic, social, historical, and I usually tackle it from this broader context. I do not speak about female circumcision as something related to sex only. No, I have to discuss it from the historical point of view, from the political point of view, from the economic and the social point of view. The other point I usually link female circumcision even to international politics. Sometimes I say there is a relationship between George Bush and female circumcision. So how come that there is a relationship? Well, because, you know, during George Bush and Ronald Reagan, they encouraged very much the religious fundamentalist groups in our region, the Islamic groups, to fight the communism and the Soviet Union. In Afghanistan, they helped the Islamic groups, fundamentalists, to fight the Soviet Union. Here in the U.S., they encouraged the Christian fundamentalist movement, and they encouraged right-wing politics. So in a way, with the revival and the encouragement of religious fundamentalism in our region, the incidence of female circumcision and veiling of women increased, because most of those groups are very hostile to women, and they are backward and reactionary, and they encourage seclusion and veiling of women and circumcision, and they scream and say women should go back home, etc., etc., all that. So in a way, there is a relationship between international politics and right-wing politics internationally and sexual oppression of women in the very small villages of Africa and female circumcision. And that's how I look to feminism. Feminism to me is global, universal, and it is broad. We cannot understand feminism or women liberation without linking the sexual oppression to the political and the economic at the international level, at the national level, and at the family level, in order to understand it.
How do you think, as you talk about the analysis of female circumcision, the political analysis, it can be dealt with?
Can be dealt with? Well, I think we have to create awareness among men and women. They must know that female circumcision is a bad habit. Quite a lot of people think it's good, it's healthy, and they should do it. Some people, they think it's God, it's a divine law. Some people think that if a girl is not circumcised, then she will lose her virginity easily and she will run after men, etc. So in a way, we have to educate people and let them know and open their eyes to the harm of female circumcision, the physical harm, the psychological harm, the social harm. The other thing is we have to change the system. We have to change the class patriarchal system. Because so long the system is there, the system can be capitalist, like in the United States, can be feudal system, can be pseudo-socialist. So we have to change, to create, mobilize people politically so that they start to be aware of the original causes of female circumcision and other types of oppression, so that people start themselves to fight against that. Women should start themselves to fight against female circumcision.
Do you see any dent being made, for example, in Egypt, in your country, in terms of female circumcision being diminished?
Oh, yes. There are many, many groups in Egypt now working against female circumcision and educating people. And even the Minister of Health himself, he issued a decree to prohibit female circumcision in hospitals and in the country. But some fundamentalist groups, try to undermine this decree. But I think that, generally speaking, we can say that most of the people in Egypt are now against female circumcision. I remember when I wrote some 35 years ago against female circumcision, the people were not ready at all to listen. And the subject was a taboo.
What about Islamic fundamentalism in Egypt, in the Middle East?
Well, it is a product, in fact, of the international and national politics. Religious fundamentalism is a political movement. It is not a religious or spiritual movement. And it's universal. It is not only Islamic. It's Christian, it is Buddhist, it's Hindu, it is Jewish. So there is a sort of revival of all religions, not only Islam, because it's international. You know, international politics itself encourages fundamentalism everywhere to oppress people, to control people, to exploit people. You cannot exploit people without religion, without frightening them of a certain divine power that will devour them if they reject injustices, etc. So in a way, religion is needed. In our region, during Sadat, for instance, during the 70s, it was Sadat himself who encouraged the Islamic fundamentalist groups in Egypt. And he encouraged also the Christian, we call it in Egypt the Coptic fundamentalist movement, for many reasons. First of all, to divide the country, divide and rule. And religion is a very, very strong weapon in division. You can divide people by religion very, very effectively. Then because he wanted to neutralize and to diminish the power of the Nasser groups and the socialist groups and the communist groups in Egypt. So he encouraged the Islamic groups, and the Islamic groups are very hostile to socialism and communism, etc. But they gained power because he encouraged them, so they gained power over the years to the extent they challenged him, and then they killed him. So the son killed the father. And this is a very common story in history.
You write in your latest book, The Nawal El-Sadawi Reader, about the impact of fanatic religious thought, and you tell the story of a young Egyptian Muslim woman.
Well, this is a story. This is a young woman who came to me because she developed a sort of neurosis. I'm a psychiatrist working, but I don't work on a regular basis. She came to my office, and she was suffering she was veiled, completely veiled. And she was working in a museum. And because of the restrictions and the fear of, you know, those women are brought up to be afraid of sex and men. They shouldn't talk to men. They shouldn't have any communication with men. Her father was very strict, so she worked in a museum with statues only. So she fell in love with a statue. So the story is about that. But you have to read it because I cannot summarize. It's very difficult.
We're talking to Dr. Nawal El-Sadawi. She is an Egyptian doctor, writer, activist, militant. She continues to speak out. She is a feminist. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Thank you. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Dr. Nawal El-Sadawi, she has come to the United States from Egypt for the Yari Yari Conference, which took place recently in New York City, to deal with the future and to deal with writers from the African diaspora, particularly black women writers. You also wrote many years ago, Women at Point Zero. You told the story of a woman who was on death row in Egypt, and you were the prison doctor.
Mm-hmm. I was not the prison doctor, in fact, at that time. At that time, when I lost my job in the Ministry of Health, I started a research called Women and Neuroses. I was asking myself why women become unhappy. So I was interviewing what they call mentally ill women or neurotic women in hospitals, in mental hospitals, and I went to prison by coincidence because the prison doctor happened to be a friend of mine and he advised me to come to prison and to interview some of the women prisoners who are neurotic. And I met the heroine of this novel, a very extraordinary personality. And I sat with her for hours in her cell, and she told me her story. She was a prostitute who killed a pimp. But the way she told her story since she was a child, and how she killed that man and why, and all her agonies and pains in life, was so illuminating to me, to the extent I couldn't sleep except after writing her story. It's a short novel, and I wrote it maybe in 2 weeks, something like that. It was like that. It came like that. And I wrote the novel, and she was executed. But this novel, in fact, made her name was Ferdows, not the real name. That's the name I put it in the book. This Ferdows lived up till now, because this book was translated to almost 28 languages all over the world. It was put in theater. This woman, the story, Woman at Point Zero, was on theater in France, in Holland, in Asia, in Europe, in America, in many places. It was played by students and by groups. So Ferdows is still living.
What did you find was compelling about her story?
The exposure of the paradoxes of the class patriarchal system. How a prostitute, she's condemned because she killed a pimp. She's condemned because she's a prostitute. But how, her story is so simple. But in spite of that, how she exposes the whole injustices, the whole paradoxes in the system. And she's a victim. She's not a criminal. She's innocent. To me, I felt she's innocent. And when she killed the pimp, she was defending her life, defending herself. She was forced to prostitution. She didn't choose it. Society forced her to be a prostitute. So in a way, but the way she told her story illuminated me. So I went back home and I wrote. So this was an exposure to a system that oppresses the weak, oppresses women, that the criminal is set free, but the victims are punished.
Where did your feminism, Dr. Nawal El-Sadawi, come from?
From childhood. I was a feminist when I was 10 years of age. My family tried to... I came from a poor family in the village. My family, and we were 9 children, 6 daughters and 3 sons. So my family wanted to marry me off when I was 10 years of age, and I rebelled because I felt that if I marry, I will be buried. So I struggled against marriage when I was 10 years of age. And how? Because I saw women around me unhappy. They were unhappy. My mother every day I heard her saying, oh, I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a famous scientist. I wanted to do something. I didn't want to live and die in the kitchen, you know. She was all the time, though she was happily married, my father was a very good man, a very good husband. He didn't marry any woman except my mother. He treated her gently. But still, she felt that she's buried in the kitchen to feed 9 children and their father. And she had a lot of ambitions. Her father, she was in school. Then her father was a military man. He took her out of school when she was 15 to marry her off to my father. So in a way, when they tried to marry me when I was 10 years, I resisted and I struggled and I rebelled and I saved myself. So I became a feminist. And also, because quite a lot of people here, especially in USA and in Europe, they think that feminism is a Western invention. You know, it's something recent. It came only here, and it's the white feminist women who created or discovered feminism. This is not true. Feminism is in every country. My mother was a feminist. She went to jail one day. My grandmother, who was a peasant, illiterate woman, she was a feminist because she was fighting against injustices in her home, in her family, and in her village. To me also, we established the Arab Women Solidarity Association. When I came out of jail, I felt that we must be a very powerful group because individuals can be imprisoned or killed, but groups cannot be killed. So we started our Arab Women Solidarity Association, and we described ourselves in 3 words: historical socialist feminist. Historical because we inherited the struggle of our mothers and grandmother and grand-grandmothers. For instance, in our history in Egypt, we had our female goddesses, Isis. She was the goddess of knowledge. I wrote a play about her. So we are inspired by women in our history, in ancient civilization. And we feel we are continuing, following their path. And we call ourselves socialists because we are against class. You cannot liberate women in a class system. You cannot liberate women in a capitalist system or a feudal system. You need equality between classes in order to have equality between sexes. So we call ourselves historical, socialist, feminist. We call ourselves feminist because we are against male domination. The same we are against class domination. So that's how we describe ourselves.
Under Hosni Mubarak, the current president of Egypt, have things changed? What do you think of President Mubarak?
Well, first of all, I am very critical of all governments. That's my philosophy. So long you have rulers and governments, you must have oppression and exploitation. Whenever we have no governments, then I think there will be equality. Because why should we have governments? That's number one. The U.S. government is exploiting the people exactly like the Egyptian, like the Moroccan, like the Sudanese. That's the core of any government. So I am critical of all governments, including the government of Egypt. That's number one, general. Number two, I see that the Mubarak regime is relatively better than the Sadat regime. Even democracy. Sadat, he said, well, Nasser was a dictator and now I'm starting democracy and we must have multi-party system. And then when we started to criticize him, then we landed in jail. So his democracy was false. Now we have some democracy. Not very big, but we have some democracy. We have opposition parties, opposition newspapers, etc. I'm not in jail. I can criticize the government, and I write articles against the Egyptian government in Cairo, in the opposition papers, and I am not in prison. So I can say it's relatively better. But still, as I told you, we need to struggle for long in order really to have to diminish or abolish the gap between the rich and the poor. The gap between the rich and the poor is increasing rapidly all over the world and increasing in our countries very much. This is the result of the system itself. But you cannot blame one ruler. I cannot say this is because the ruler himself is not good. It is the system itself. Even if the ruler he comes first and he's enthusiastic and he wants to change, but the system swallows him.
Egypt receives more money, more U.S. aid, than any other country in the world outside of Israel. It's the number two recipient of U.S. foreign aid. What do you think of that?
I am very much against aid. I don't believe in charity or aid. The word aid itself is wrong. Because if you study, and I wrote in my book here, in one of my articles, if you really study the money that comes from the U.S. to Egypt, where it goes back to the pockets of U.S. people. And so Egypt doesn't gain a lot of this aid. And the philosophy of aid itself is based on exploitation. You know, so money, you hear people think that the third world, Africa, Egypt, poor countries are receiving aid from the first world, from the rich countries. This is not true. The flow of money, in fact, goes from the so-called third world to the first, rather than from the first to the third. And we receive back a minute portion of what we already paid under the name aid. So aid, we lose money. Under the word aid, we lose money. And we lose our dignity too, because we are dignified. Egypt is a very dignified country. So we cannot, some people think we are living on the aid coming to us from the U.S., that the U.S. feeds us, you know. This is not true.
Explain what you mean when you say the money goes to U.S. people.
Yes, you have to read, there are many details about that. For instance, the money that goes to Egypt is paid indirectly to U.S. experts in Egypt, you know, so their salaries. The military aid goes where? We do not fight. So we buy military arms, etc., which we do not use. The budget, the military budget in Egypt and in many African countries, we don't use it. Because here in the U.S., this is a military capitalist complex, and they need profit, you know, the main profit of the multinationals. The multinationals, 500 multinationals, they own 80% of the money of the world. And the multinationals cannot live without profit. And the profit is like cancer, you know. And the major profit that goes to the multinationals come from the arms sold to the so-called third world and to other countries, and from drugs and from makeup to women, you know, and these things. So in a way, if we study the economics of the multinationals and of the international capitalist system, we find that they need war in order to continue the profit. And when one enemy disappears, you know, when the Soviet Union disappeared, this was the traditional enemy, the communist enemy. When the Soviet Union fell, then this military complex had to create a new enemy. So the Gulf War happened for the oil, of course. The Gulf War happened for the oil. And also to run the machine. The military machine has to go on working, and the industry producing arms has to go on, and the profit has to go on.
How do you think the situation between the Arab countries and Israel will be resolved?
This is a big problem because, in fact, there is a lot of injustice here. We are living in a world that respects power only. I'll give you just one example. Egypt and the Arab countries was compelled by the USA to sign the agreement to have a free nuclear zone, not to own nuclear weapons at all, even for peace. Even so, we are not allowed to have any nuclear weapons. Israel didn't sign the agreement, and they have now an arsenal nuclear power, and they are accumulating nuclear power and threatening us whenever there is a problem with a conflict. Israel will threaten with the nuclear power. So how can you see peace like that? Peace cannot happen except when there is justice. But when you accumulate nuclear power in a country like Israel and deprive all other countries in the region from nuclear power, then what you expect? That's number one. Number two, the USA government supports Israel all the time, even if Netanyahu is killing people in Palestine. And the settlement, you know, this settlement, the UN, how many UN resolutions were issued against what the Israeli government is doing? And the Israeli government never respected the UN resolutions. And the Israeli government was never punished. Look at Iraq government. I was very much against the invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein, but see how Iraq was punished by such a war, and how up till now by the embargo. You know that every day 500 children die in Iraq every day because of the embargo. So you see how Iraq is punished severely by war and by the embargo up till now because they violated the UN resolutions. And Israel is violating the UN resolutions and not respecting the UN resolutions for years and never punished. So that's how we look to it if we really speak about justice. We have to look at it like that.
We're talking to Dr. Nawal El-Sadawi. And Dr. El-Sadawi, I'm looking at your latest book, The Nawal El-Sadawi Reader, and on the cover is a quote, "Why keep asking me about my identity?" Can you talk about that and also about this whole issue that is being raised now about you as an Egyptian woman, about Egyptians, about people in the Middle East and North Africa, whether you are Arab or whether you are African?
Well, I think there is a big illusion and a political, it's political. The word identity itself is a very ambiguous word. And it's now everybody speaking about identity, culture, authentic identity, culture, multiculturalism, all that specific cultures. And they speak about conflicts between cultures or conflicts between civilizations. And they separate between culture and economy, as if the problem now is cultural conflicts and identity problems, not money, not economy, not the land, all that. So that's number one. So we should not separate at all between what's happening in the economy and what's happening in culture. Even the GATT treatment and other international agreements, they combine economy with culture. They do not separate. This globalization, the so-called globalization, economic and cultural globalization, it's neo-colonialism, in fact. It is neo-colonialism. It's a new way of colonizing and exploiting people. So the identity is a very vague and misleading word. And they are using it to divert us from the real, original, concrete economic problems we are facing. Number two, I am from Egypt.
and I'm African. My continent, you know, when I was attending this African women writers, an American woman came to me and said, oh, but is Egypt in Africa? She didn't know that Egypt in Africa. I told her, where is Egypt? She said, in the Middle East. I told her, and where is the Middle East? She didn't know. So in a way, she was trying to cut my identity. She was trying to cut me away from my continent. That's Africa, because Egypt is in Africa. So I'm African. I am an Arab because I speak Arabic. I write in Arabic. So how can this is part of my identity? Part of my identity is my language. It's very important. Part of my identity is the continent. The land I was born on. That's Africa, etc. So they don't look to that, and they want first of all to abolish the word Arab. Arab became now the new enemy. Arab. They say it's Islam, the new enemy now. But really the new enemy after the Soviet Union are the Arabs. And generally the so-called third world people. The word Arab has disappeared. And they replaced it by Middle East. You know, they don't say the Arab world. They say the Middle East. But it's funny because what's the Middle East? Middle between what? Because middle means middle between something. So for me, I say, well, England can be the Middle West and America can be the Far West to me, relative to me as an Egyptian.
Dr. Nawal El-Saadawy is our guest for this hour. Dr. El-Saadawy is a writer, doctor, and militant jailed under Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, speaking with Dr. Nawal El-Saadawy. She's a medical doctor, she's a writer, she's a militant, she's a feminist. She deals with many topics in the books that she has written, including interpretations of Islam, the role of women in African literature. She talks about sexual politics of development initiatives to tourism in a post-colonial age.
How does the Arab world view women in resistance?
Women in resistance. In the Arab world, we are resisting all the time. All the time, you know. Arab women, like American women, like women in any country, are resisting. Are resisting, and they are fighting. That's a human nature. Human nature is when you are oppressed, you fight. So they are fighting since the evolution of the class patriarchal system, since the change of the society from the matriarchal society to the patriarchal society. And I see that in the history of Egypt, where in ancient Egypt, when women were respected, they were goddesses. And the mother gave her name to her children. How the society changed with the socioeconomic and political changes, and women lost their status in religion, in philosophy, in science, in art, and became, instead of representing the divine power, they represent this devilish power, devil. They became the devils. This is related to the whole political changes and the evolution of the class patriarchal system. Since then, women didn't stop resisting. They didn't stop up till now. They went to jail. They were killed. They were labeled, but they never stopped. And some people think that the Arab women are veiled. You know, here the image of the Arab women is very, very strange. Either a veiled woman or a belly dancer, you know, nothing in between. As if there are no doctors. There are millions of doctors like me in the Arab world. In, you know, the percentage of educated women in universities in Egypt is much higher than in the USA or Canada. Yes, we have many professionals, many women, lawyers, doctors, engineers, writers, etc. But here in the West, they do not know except either the veiled woman or the belly dancer. That's the media, how the media distorts the image of Arab women, and it is political.
You've been to the United States many times. You also taught at Duke University. What has it been like for you as an Arab woman, as a woman from the continent of Africa, to teach here?
Well, I think it was a very enjoyable and rich experience for me. And my class was not only American students, they were international. I had students from India, from Egypt, from America, from China. So it was a very international class. And I taught a new course which I called Dissidence and Creativity, which I enjoyed. And I used my novels and other novels written by some Arab writers, men and women. And for me, I spent 4 years in Duke and another year in University of Washington in Seattle. So all in all, was 5 years. And this was, though it was almost exile, you know, because I did not come to the U.S. by choice. I had to leave my country after the Gulf War because we opposed the Arab Women's Solidarity Association, our association, opposed the Gulf War. So the government banned us, closed the association illegally. So we had to sue the government and to have problems with the government. And then the government put security guards around my house and bodyguard to protect my life. And I was astonished. Why? Who wants to kill me? And then some official people in the government said, it is some religious fundamentalist groups. So in a way, I lived under those guards, very threatened, because I was protected by a government that wants to get rid of me. And I didn't trust the guards themselves. So I felt like being a sandwich between the government and the religious groups. And I had to leave the country. And I left, and I lived here in exile. But it was not really exile. I felt I am having a very rich experience to be a professor in Duke University and in University of Washington. And it was a totally new experience for me. And I discovered that my books are read here. The students love the books. We have a lot of discussions. So it was really very enriching to me.
Dissidence and creativity. What is it about these two qualities that feed on each other?
I think that we are all, first of all, we are born all creative. But we lose our creativity by education and training and obedience and religious teachings. We become obedient. And obedience and creativity, obedience is the antithesis of creativity. Creativity is based on disobedience. In a sense, you are, because you are creative, you feel you are dissatisfied with the system that is unjust. That's natural. You know, when I was a child, I became a feminist because they wanted to oppress me when I was a little girl. They discriminated between me and my boy, my brother. They wanted to marry me off and to deprive me from school. So I felt injustices, and I had to be disobedient. to my father, to my mother, even to God. Because everywhere my parents, my family, they say to me, that's what God said, you know? That's what God said. Anything I want to do and they prevent me from doing, they said, this is what God said. So I had to rebel even against God. So dissidence is very natural for any human being facing injustices. But creative people, though, as I told you, I don't divide people to creative and non-creative. We are all creative, but we lose our creativity because of many reasons. When we do not lose our creative power, then the ability to disobey increases, and you become dissident. You become alone because the mainstream people and most of the people live in fear and die in fear because they are afraid to be punished by God or by parents or by professors or by the system, by the government. They are afraid of jailing, of prison. They are afraid of losing their reputation or losing their posts, their money. So because of this fear, they cannot be dissident. But what happened to me that I lost my job? I went to jail. I lost my money. I lost my reputation. I was about to lose my life. So in a way, I was exposed. And this brings some courage, some dissidence. You feel that you are right. And also because your economic needs diminish. You don't need many things. My needs in life are not too many. I can live simply. I can live in a very simple life. So my economic needs are very limited. And this makes you free also, because we become slaves to our economic needs. And the media and the society and the multinational and the whole capitalist system increases consumerism. We live in consumer societies in which you are compelled to buy things that you do not need. So in a way, when you are creative and when you are really sensitive to injustices in the society, you are indifferent to this luxury life. You create a different way of happiness. You become happy when you write a book, for instance. You become happy when people recognize your efforts. You become happy when you feel that some groups are fighting against injustice. You know, so your happiness is totally different from the happiness of people when they own money or have a nice car or something like that. So dissidence and creativity are much... very much related. When you are creative, you have to be dissident. You are dissatisfied with the system. You cannot be silent when you see people killed. You cannot be silent when you feel that people are oppressed. You cannot be silent when you see that the victim is punished while the criminal is set free. So you feel it's physical. It's not something you think about. Spontaneously, you resist.
Although you're still producing and you're still very creative, as you look back on your life, would you do anything differently?
No. If I go back to my life, I think I will follow the same route, the same path, because I felt what gives me a lot of optimism and power also, that I feel I was right. I was right. Even when I was in jail, I felt what I am doing is right. Something, the inner voice inside me tells me that what I'm doing is right. I may be wrong, but I feel that what I'm doing is right. And I feel happy with that. I am satisfied with what I am doing. And I use my common sense, you know. It's not. It doesn't need genius to discover injustices in society. Simple people understand that. My grandmother, who was illiterate and a peasant, poor woman, I was 5 years when I used to go with her to the mayor, and she was fighting against the mayor of the village who was exploiting the poor villagers like my grandmother. And she mobilized the men and women in her village against the mayor. And I remember I was 5 years, and she took me with her to the mayor. And she was standing, she was tall and strong, and standing in front of the mayor with no shoes in her feet, and a poor woman, and telling him, you should not exploit us, because God will be angry with you. God is justice. And we have a proverb in Arabic that says, رَبِّنَا هُوَ الْعَدْلَ عَرْفُوا بِالْعَقْلِ. She told him, God is justice, and I knew him by my common sense, by my brain. He was carrying the Quran and telling her, you ignorant woman, you don't know God because you didn't read the Quran, you didn't know anything. But she was arguing with him and telling him, no, I know God more than you, because God is not a book. God is justice. So I learned, this is the whole philosophy of Islam, the whole philosophy of any religion, that God is justice, freedom, and love. And simple, illiterate people understand that without reading holy books. God does not come out of the printing machine. God is this ability to fight for justice. And it's related to creativity. Creativity is related to the ability to fight for justice. Because creative people cannot sleep if there is injustices around them.
Dr. Nawal El-Sadawi, author of many books, her latest, The Nawal El-Sadawi Reader. It's published by Zed Books and distributed by St. Martin Press in the United States. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, on New Year's Eve, we take a shortcut through 1997.
What will you remember about 1997?
It was raining in Ketchikan. This is like saying it was hilly in San Francisco, or it was crowded in Tokyo.
I think we must bear in mind that the political structure for the future is very clearly defined in the Basic Law.
Here was a situation which hadn't ever happened before in history.
He butted me in the first round, but then he butted me again in the second round. Then as soon as he butted me, I watched him.
Media were everywhere.
From my point of view, I just felt that I had to end this ordeal myself.
And here was a fairy story that everybody wanted to work.
Would you like to know more?
Tune in for a shortcut.
We'll be there.
If you'd like a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to write to us, our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. If you'd like to use the post office, you can send us a letter at Democracy Now!, WBAI, Pacifica Radio, 505 8th Avenue, New York, New York, 10018. That's Democracy Now!, WBAI Pacifica Radio, 505 8th Avenue, New York, New York, 10018. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another holiday edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!